Science, broadcasting from the campus of Loyola University. And this is the Logic Consortium. And today we have a very special live in-studio interview. So we'll be taking all calls today at 773-508-WLUW. And we're very pleased to have Dr. Alexandra Felindra, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And we're going to be talking about a recent article that she wrote entitled The Myth of Self-Deportation. We're going to be talking a lot about immigration today. Immigration, the economics of immigration, and also the history of immigration. Dr. Felindra, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Jake. Thank you for having me.
Of course. About the article, so it basically debunks this idea that state and local immigration laws and enforcement of those will cause people to self-deport.
That's correct. Yes. That idea that there is going to be attrition through enforcement, as proponents of this type of restriction call it, is based on a flawed logic, essentially. It's based on a paradigm in economics that is called expected utility theory, and which has an understanding of how people behave that is actually not consistent with what we know from psychology about real, actual human behavior. And as a result, there's a huge discrepancy between what is expected by people like Mitt Romney, who has been advocating for self-deportation, and what actual people do.
Okay, so let's talk about this in the context of these local and state laws that have been passed, which are very relevant today considering the Supreme Court decision of June 25th of this year.
Absolutely.
So can you kind of lay out this recent immigration legislation that has been passed and the idea kind of that has motivated these laws?
Absolutely. So these laws basically require local and state police and other state employees to check for people's IDs and aggressively report and go after people who have irregular documentation. They don't have the proper documents to be in the United States. And the expectation is that if we give police full authority to check everybody's papers and go in and check people to see in their cars or in their homes or wherever, to be able to check for their documentation, what is going to happen is people are going to realize that the cost associated with staying in the United States, given that the risk of being deported is going to increase, is going to be seen as too much to bear. And because in this paradigm, people are thought to be rational, and I will explain what that means, because that's not our everyday use of the term rational. It's a very specific meaning to the term. And because people are rational, they will do a cost-benefit calculation. And they will say, oh, you know, if I get caught, there's a high chance of me getting caught. It's not worth it to stay here, so I will just pick up and leave. And in that sense, advocates of this type of legislation say, look, you give the police more powers to enforce immigration law, people are going to get more scared and realize that they really can't stay here, and they will pick up and leave. And that's the logic behind it.
Let me just remind our audience, today we're lucky enough to have Dr. Alexandra Felindra in the studio, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we're taking all calls on immigration. Right now we're talking about the immigration laws, the local laws, state and local laws that were passed in the last couple of years. And notwithstanding, and let me just say, 773-508-WLUW, and we'd be happy to take any questions, any comments on local immigration laws, national immigration laws, the economics of immigration, immigrant workers coming to Chicago or anywhere else. Dr. Falinger, notwithstanding, leaving the Supreme Court's decision aside for a second still, and the Supreme Court did strike down many of these laws.
Absolutely.
But were these laws even working in the eyes of the advocates? I think that's one of the big questions that's brought up in your paper.
These laws cannot effectively work, essentially. Let's put aside the legalities of them, and let's even put aside the cost of them, because the cost is enormous. Because there is legal costs associated, because, you know, when you're going after undocumented people, you catch a lot of citizens in the net, and that has legal implications because people will sue if they're mistreated by the police. But setting that aside, setting the additional cost of having police do overtime in order to take on additional responsibilities that they previously did not have, let's talk about the logic of the policy itself and whether it can work. And the policy is supposed to work by basically encouraging people to leave the country because their costs of staying have gone up. The problem with that logic is that the proponents do not realize that these people have made huge investments in being here. They're tied here by investments that they have already made, what we call in economics sunk costs or dead losses. Basically, these people own homes here. They have families here. Their kids go to school. They have a social network to which they belong. They own cars. They own assets. They have bank accounts. They have an entire life here. And it is not easy, and it's not something that people are willing to give up that easily. Even though in terms of strict economic theory, as the costs of staying here go up, people in theory should consider, more and more people should consider leaving. In reality, people are kept here because of the investments that they have already made, because they don't want to lose what they have already built here, because they have all these links here, and that keeps them here. And what is going to happen is people are going to take more risk in order to stay into the country. People's attitude to risk is going to change. And unlike what economic rationality expects and what economists, classical economists think, which is that people's propensity to risk, the way that they think of risk, is given. In reality, what people do is they are actually willing to change how much risk they're willing to tolerate in order not to lose what they already have. So we are, as humans, we are really driven by not losing. We have what we call loss aversion. We do not want to lose the things that we already have, and we are willing to take very, very high gambles in order to maintain what we have, and not to lose what we have. And for that reason, the cost of implementing these kinds of legislations, and really, if we really effectively wanted to, for a program like that to work, we would have to make it nearly impossible for somebody not to be found out. And that is practically and legally and constitutionally not possible to do. We would have to create a system which is closer to Hitler's Germany than anything that a modern democracy could tolerate.
So because of the lives that people have built here, even in the face of these strict laws that these states and localities were passing, people were not leaving.
Nope, they're not going to leave, and there is evidence already of that. There are a few studies that have been done, preliminary studies in a couple of states, and it shows that they're not leaving. And even journalistic accounts out of Alabama. Alabama passed the most restrictive law after Arizona. with a lot of problems. And even though initial accounts said that people are leaving, later on the trend reversed and families went back. So as soon as things settled down and they knew what was going on, they were actually willing to take the chance of being caught by Alabama police on the road. What happens is people don't drive. They have to take 2, 3, 5, 10 buses to get to work. They have to walk. They have to have a very difficult life in order to avoid contact with the police, which also means that if a crime happens in their neighborhood, they're not going to report it because they're afraid of being found out and as undocumented, which is bad for us, for the rest of us, because crime goes unreported, because the police doesn't have the information it needs to combat the real dangers of criminal activity in neighborhoods.
And the Supreme Court last month of the United States found most of these laws to be unconstitutional anyway.
That's true. A lot of the provisions that were included in terms of restricting certain rights that undocumented people have were found unconstitutional. The one thing that's still pending is the provision about asking for papers, but even there the Supreme Court said we will be watching because even the Supreme Court recognized that there is a real high likelihood of racial profiling. No matter what Arizona says and no matter what kind of regulations and training they may have out there, it is very, very difficult not to use racial profiling when you're looking for undocumented immigrants, given that the vast majority of undocumented immigrants come from specific communities. And there is a very long history of using racial profiling both by the Border Patrol and by police to identify people. And when you're casting such a net, you're going to catch residents, you're going to catch citizens, you're going to catch the guy in Arizona who was the Toyota executive or Honda executive who was Japanese and, you know, he ended up, or the German, I can't remember, was one of the auto executives who was a foreigner and wasn't carrying proper identification at the time, and he was hauled to the police department. And those are things that Americans do not think are appropriate, to be hauling people who haven't done anything wrong for identification at the police station. Those are not practices associated with the way we understand civil liberties.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking to Dr. Alexandra Falindra about immigration, and we're taking all calls. We're talking about immigration laws. Now we're going to be kind of talking about the economics of immigration. And 773-508-WLUW. And we'd love to hear your comments or questions. Dr. Falindra, moving on a little bit from the paper and this idea that local laws would cause people to self-deport, which we were just talking about, to more of a lot of people who are against immigration say that the immigrants are taking Americans' jobs, and they're a drain on the social services and on the local economies. Can you talk about what you think of these arguments?
Well, economic studies, for the most part, show that this is not really the case, and that immigration has incredible economic benefits. Any kind of social change, any kind of social phenomenon has both costs and benefits, and the idea is how do we evaluate both? First of all, on the national level, undocumented immigrants, whether they use fake social security numbers or any way they get paid, for the most part, pay Social Security taxes. And Social Security is receiving a significant, and Social Security Administration did a study where it shows that it's receiving significant amounts of money from undocumented immigrants, which they will never be able to reclaim. This is money that basically keeps Social Security solvent for the rest of us, because these people will never essentially be able to claim that money back. So for the federal government, undocumented immigration financially has been pretty much of a boom. In terms of the state, things are a bit more complicated because states are paying for some of the unreimbursed emergency room expenses, and also for education is the big outlay for state governments. On the education front, we need to understand where the money for education comes from, and it comes from local taxes, and especially property taxes. Now, as the Urban Institute has indicated, 35% of undocumented people own homes in the United States. These people pay local taxes, they pay property taxes directly, and they have every right to have access to an educational system for which they're paying. The rest of the people who rent homes, obviously, you know, they don't live out in a camp somewhere, they rent homes. And that means that they also pay property taxes indirectly because the landlord pays property taxes. So since they actually are contributing to the local tax base, they are paying their share, as much as the rest of us are, for the education that their children receive. So in that sense, the fairness argument is, if they're paying for it, why not? They should be receiving it. From a practicality perspective, excluding people from education is never a good idea, because you want to educate everybody, you want everybody to have access, because that's what gives you the value added in your economy. We are in a high-tech economy, and the more people we have who are highly educated, the better we are. Our problem in the U.S. is we're not getting enough people out of high school. It's not that we have to exclude people from going to school. And we should be thinking of it in those terms. So I think that there are definitely ways to think about the costs and benefits, even at the state and local level, of immigrants. The other issue is, do they take away jobs? And a lot of studies have shown that because most immigrants come into the economy at the lowest levels, they do manual labor, they work at McDonald's, they are janitors, they do the least paying jobs, which most Americans don't want to do. These jobs otherwise would go unfilled. So in a sense, they're complementary to the economy. They do things that the rest of us don't want to do. And not only that, but they add to the economy through their salary, because by doing these jobs, they make money, they use this money in the local economy. The economic basis expands, and that way the economy actually grows. And having a larger population in the United States has allowed us more economic stability and growth. Immigration, in a sense, stimulates in the long term the American economy, and that's a good thing.
So this idea that immigrants are coming and taking jobs and causing a higher unemployment rate, you don't think it has much to offer? We do have a call. Hello? Hello? Hello, you're on the air. I don't know if we can get him in right now. Do you think that you don't think that argument holds much water, that the immigrants are causing a higher unemployment rate?
No. Definitely not. I don't think that that is an issue with immigration. Immigration doesn't cause additional unemployment rate. The studies show that there may be an effect in terms of displacement with especially in minority communities with African Americans and within the Latino community, but the effects are fairly small, around 3 or 4% which of jobs that immigrants take are have an effect of being displaced. So it's the economy that's causing unemployment. It's the fact that we've lost the manufacturing bases that's causing unemployment. We are losing service jobs, too. Lower-end service jobs are going abroad as well. So we have tax laws and we have business laws that support the exportation of jobs. We are actually sending a lot of jobs abroad, and that's what's hurting the economy. That's what's hurting employment, and we have an educational system that doesn't help people get the skills that they need for the types of jobs that pay well. Today, we are getting to a situation where the middle class is disappearing. The jobs that were in manufacturing, that were in the auto sector, that were in the mechanics and all that, those kinds of jobs that were high-paying union jobs in the 1950s and 60s that built the middle class, that built the economy, all of those jobs are disappearing. And we're developing a society that is bifurcated. Think of like a camel's back. Most of the people are under this big hump and of the camel, and those are the people that have low-wage jobs, no security, and nowhere to go. And then there's another little hump, which is the rich people, the people who have college degrees and advanced degrees and money and the doctors and the lawyers who make a good living. But the middle class is what's in the valley between the two humps, and there are not enough people there because there are not enough jobs there. We're losing that base because of globalization, because of other forces. And we need to be concerned about that and how to move the people from the big hump into the middle class, and we're not doing enough of that. Immigration is not the problem there.
I think, let me remind our audience, this is the Logic Consortium, and today we're speaking about immigration laws and policies and economics with Dr. Alexandra Felindra, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois Chicago. And we are taking calls. We just had a little bit of a technical difficulty on it, but thank you, caller, for calling in. Please call back at 773-508-WLUW, and we'll put you live on the air. I think we have it figured out now. And so, yeah, we'll move on, and hopefully the caller can be so nice to call back. So I wanted to kind of move from state and local laws, which we talked about at the beginning in your article, and now we just spoke about the economics and jobs and immigration's effect on employment, to the history of immigration law. There's this idea that people's grandfathers and great-grandfathers came over here legally and they knew what... Can you talk about some of the misconceptions involved in when people talk about the history of immigration law?
Absolutely. The first immigration laws that imposed serious restrictions to immigration. So basically the idea of having people who were illegal in a sense were enacted in the 1920s, in 1924 and 1929. They were called the National Origins Laws. And basically that's when you start actually having the United States restricting the entry of immigrants. And the big concern at the time, which people don't know about, was actually European, and specifically Southern European, Italian, Greek immigration, people from Eastern Europe, like people from Hungary, from Russia, Jewish people. all of those people from the eastern parts of Europe and from the southern parts of Europe at the time were considered unsuitable for the United States, because in many ways, reminiscing of today's debates, they didn't speak English. They were considered racially different. At the time, people who had Western European origin thought of themselves as white, but Italians and even Irish for most of the 19th century were not considered white. And therefore, in order to sustain racial purity, in the 1920s, the United States imposed a series of laws to restrict immigration of people of those backgrounds, of Italian background and Greek background and Lebanese background and Eastern European, Russian, Polish backgrounds. All of these people were excluded. And what happened after that is that a large number of people from those countries came in sneaking through the border. It was much easier then because there was not really much of a border patrol. But a lot of people came in either through Canada or through the southern border, sneaking in because they wanted to avail themselves of the jobs and of the opportunities. And they were similar people. They were hardworking people who had entrepreneurial spirit and wanted to make it in the United States. And actually, there are words that we still use today that evoke that illegal, undocumented status of the earlier generations. For example, Italians are often called whoppers. And the term whopper comes from without papers. A whop is a person without papers. And because many people within the Italian community in the early part of the 20th century came in without proper documentation, they were known as whoppers. It was the illegals of their time. So the idea that everybody in the past came in legally is kind of a myth. It's a fiction. Yes, a lot of people came in through the Ellis Island process, but a lot of people didn't. Canadians could come and go all the time. There's a huge undocumented Canadian community all through the 20th century in the United States. So this is just today's way of creating divisions and sort of making the past look much better than it really was, or much different than today's society. But in reality, it's very similar. And we have to be conscious, I think, and understand the difficulties and the discrimination that our ancestors faced in the early part of the 20th century for those who have immigrant ancestors. Racism in the United States against immigrants goes back a very, very long way. About 200 years ago, Benjamin Franklin, more than 200 years ago, Benjamin Franklin actually was very concerned about German immigration, because the Germans would corrupt the white English race, and the Germans would bring in German language and they would Germanize the English settlers rather than the English settlers anglicizing them. That was the founder of the United States. Benjamin Franklin was talking about how the Germans were a horrible people to be coming into the United States. Later on, it was the Irish. The Irish spread enormous fear in the 1850s throughout the United States because they were Catholics. And Catholicism was basically a cult in the mid-19th century to Protestant Americans. They really feared the Pope. They really feared Catholicism. And as a result, they treated the Irish much like today we treat Latino immigrants, even worse. They were excluded from jobs. There were ads all over papers. If you look at papers from the 1850s, The Pennsylvania Historical Society has this really nice website that has job ads from the period, and they say things like, Mr. So-and-so is looking for a tailor. No Irish need apply. And by the 1890s, it was no Italians need apply. And today, we're to the point what we're saying implicitly, no Latino needs apply. Is that where we're going? So we have a history of this, and people need to be aware that this is what we have been doing for 200 years, and this is the opportunity for us to change it.
Dr. Philindra, thank you so much, and I really enjoyed the interview, and invite you back anytime.
Anytime you want me, I'm here.
Thank you. And that's the show for today. Have a great day. Thank you, everybody.